Hello and welcome to another episode of The Grey NATO. It's a loose discussion of travel, diving, driving gear, and most certainly watches. This is episode 170. We thank you for listening. Jason, how you doing?
Good. We're churning along 170. We're here. We are approaching 200. I remember 100 like it was yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, I guess where does that put us? Probably late spring for 200. We'll have to figure out something fun.
Yeah,
we have some fun announcement coming next week.
Yeah,
which so tune in for that if you're keen, especially if you'd like if you have any interest in sort of supporting the show or that sort of stuff. And then as far as this week, we actually delayed this episode one day. Because of one of the watches we're going to be talking about later in the show came out this morning. So the morning that this launches, at the same time, actually, we did, not only did we delay a day, we delayed it kind of 27 hours. We normally go up, nobody cares about this, just me. We normally go up at 6 a.m. ET, and then whenever I actually wake up, I publish the notes to Substack, maybe an hour, hour and a half later. And this time we're going to go up at 9. So it's a little later, but we thank everyone for the patience. We wanted to be able to talk about the new Aquastar Deep Star 2 as part of the main topic. There's been two exciting dive watches that kind of came out since we recorded the last episode. And obviously both are actually are pretty in our wheelhouse, I think, and come from people that we know and like and kind of have an interesting history. So that's going to be the big kind of middle part of the show. But Jason, what I'd like to hear about is this is your trip up to the sort of beacon lighting for the Edmund Fitzgerald. How was that?
It was good fun. You know, I think I highly encourage people to, if you have weird spontaneous whims or excuses to get out of town for like micro adventures, just go and do it, because, you know, so often we plan like a long weekend or a week long vacation, and then either it doesn't come to fruition or it gets over planned and doesn't happen or something. And we kind of decided to do this, you know, the day we recorded last week. It was not that long ago.
Yeah, right. It feels like longer than that.
We pretty much just cooked this strange. Up. This cabin that we rented was the same one we rented back in April when we went up there, and it just so happens that it popped up with a reduced rate because they had an opening midweek, and it happened to be over the days of this annual beacon lighting at the Split Rock Lighthouse to commemorate the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald in Lake Superior. And I was like, it kind of all came together, and I said, let's take off and do this. And Gashani was able to, you know, quickly take the time off of work, and we loaded up the Land Rover and drove up, and you know, it was fun. It was quirky. It was, you know, the weather wasn't spectacular. It wasn't terribly cold, but kind of a gale blew up just on time for the beacon lighting. This, you know, winds kicked up and the waves were crashing on the shore, which was very fitting for what we were there for. And so it was fun. This lighthouse was built in 1905. So it's old, it's beautiful, it's very picturesque. It sits on a cliff over Lake Superior. And, you know, we've been there several times. In fact, we've dived in the water below the lighthouse because there's a shipwreck just down there. But, you know, they had the lighthouse staff was reading the names of the deceased from the shipwreck of the Fitzgerald. And then there was a small choir that sang the naval hymn. And then at 4:30, which is pretty much dusk, they lit up the beacon, which they don't do regularly because that lighthouse is now not in service. They, you know, ship navigation on the Great Lakes is done via GPS nowadays. And so you don't need visual cues from lighthouses to tell where you are. So that was kind of a thrill. We were up on the observatory deck of the lighthouse. And then when they lit it up after the ceremony, we hiked down to a beach, probably about a mile down the beach, and kind of wraps around into this cove. And you can see the lighthouse from a distance, and great place to take pictures. And neither of us had brought the right longer lenses that we needed, but it was still fun. We were kind of setting up in the dark. We had tripods, and Gashani had her Nikon Z7, and then I used my old F3 film camera, which has a self timer and has an auto exposure function, which was novel back in the early 80s. And so I set it up and got it in as good a focus as I could from that distance, and let her rip. And so I haven't developed the film yet, but I'm eager to see what comes of it. So
that's great. Well, we'll put some of those photos in the show notes as well.
Yeah, and other than that, we kind of just stayed at this beautiful A-frame cabin up on a hill and hiked a little bit and read a lot. And then we actually, you know, I brought my new MacBook up, not with the intention of doing any work, but in case we wanted to stream some shows. And you had mentioned, I think it was last week in Final Notes, that The Alpinist, that movie, was available on Prime Video. And so we streamed that. And it was as good as you said. I mean, it was as good as all the hype. And it was just a tremendously powerful, sobering, beautifully made movie. I mean, just everything about it, the footage, the way that it was done, it was very thoughtfully and compassionately done, and kind of makes you think about a lot of things. And it was really good. So I'm not going to go into the detail that, that you did last time, other than to just encourage people to check that out.
Definitely worth checking out for sure. Yeah.
And then another movie we watched was, actually this was after we got home, was Roadrunner, the movie about Anthony Bourdain, which I know you've seen as well. And
I haven't, I have yet to watch it. I wanted to get through his entire, I wanted to get through his entire thing. And then I read some kind of semi-negative stuff about people who knew him really well, who said that the movie didn't, like, kind of did him dirty. Like didn't paint all sides of it, kind of painted the part that people already knew, that the part, obviously the depression, the sadness, the kind of emptiness, that's that part, but not the whole picture, which I'm not sure what the veracity of that is. But when we get to the end of probably the three shows, maybe even the three shows in the book, I think that's when I'd be ready to be able to watch that and then see if I had the context for it or not. What did you think of it?
Yeah, we both really liked it. I mean, it was a terribly sad movie, and to watch that on the heels of watching The Alpinist, kind of, not to get overly philosophical, but they both have this
similarity there,
underlying element of people dying too soon and for arguably questionable reasons, both of them in very different circumstances. But it was you could say it was kind of a grim pair of movies to watch, kind of back to back, but both really really well done. I don't know the, like you said, I don't know the veracity of the claims about Roadrunner, and how objective it was or whatever. But
I mean, it's really hard to hit a really strong balance when the core topic, the subject material, isn't there to speak for themselves.
To
provide any context, I think that's a tough one. I think what is interesting, especially for those two movies, is they exemplify two people that were very much, had some acclaim. Obviously with Bourdain, we're talking about worldwide fame. At one point, 20 million households could have watched his show at any point. A really remarkable, I bet you that number was much higher actually later on. I just remember him saying that at one point during a joke, said, that they couldn't get into a certain spot in Romania. And he was like, there's a lot of people that watch this show, but sure, we'll just go do something else. two guys that really kind of wore their almost pathological need to do what they like to do right on their sleeve.
It was
a big piece of their personality.
Yeah.
And there's really no comparing the way that both of them kind of met their end.
Right.
Two kind of entirely different scenarios, but I think both really beautiful and human. I haven't seen Roadrunner. I've seen the trailer, and obviously I understand a lot of what went on with Bourdain just in following his life and his work and stuff. And, just two really kind of beautiful people that had not just demons, but just, that seemed to have a kind of supernatural push to do and to see and to experience and to live life almost to their own metric.
Yeah.
Even if it didn't work out.
Right. Right.
It's definitely not an easy double header for sure. I hope you watch something maybe a little bit lighter at some point in the last few days.
Yeah, really. And then going to the ceremony for a deceased shipwreck.
Yeah, true. Yeah,
I don't know. I don't feel particularly down after that. It was...
No.
Yeah, but I can see you're that. Right. Yeah, maybe it's time to pull up a comedy or something. But how about you? What I saw you ran into some snow at the cottage. We got a little bit here.
Yeah, so I was, work has been insane. The hours have just been crazy. So I had this little window where it looked like my brothers would be up at the cottage, and this is probably, I mean, it's always hard to say. We might have another weekend up there before it's legitimately too cold to keep the space warm, because we didn't do any of the winterizing stuff, or the really, not just winterizing, but like making it ready for winter. This year. But so went up for a day and a half and kind of kicked around and took some pictures and watch some Bourdain and just kind of relax. And it was pretty good. It felt really good. And like you said, it's nice to have these kind of impromptu, I wouldn't call this an adventure necessarily, but then it snowed and we got to do that. And
yeah.
And those sorts of things. So it was nice to get up there. The while we were there, the Jeep ran over 200,000 kilometers. So that was kind of a nice little point in time. I guess that gives me about 22,000 kilometers I've put on it since we bought it.
Wow.
And and then the other one I would highlight is I've been there twice now, once outside when it was nicer weather and then once inside because it was fairly cold, is this Boschkung Brewing. So if you're around Ontario, you've access to Ontario beers. Pretty solid stuff. They didn't really have anything bad. They've got a lot of really funny merch and the rest of it, but they're kind of operating. They have two breweries, like brew restaurants in the Minden area, which is kind of in the general area of where my cottage is, you know, an hour or so away, but it's a beautiful drive nonetheless. Yeah, they have a sort of tap room below a restaurant called Rhubarb in just outside of Minden, Ontario. And if you're ever up that way and you drive by and you see this, it looks like a big black barn and then giant letters, this is Rhubarb, and you're interested in a solid pint, check it out. They make really good stuff. They're definitely worth a shout out.
Nice.
And I'll put them in the show notes. I don't know. I'm sure there's plenty of folks listening that like to drink beer, but I'm not sure how far any of this stuff ever gets distributed. You know, there was a lot of stuff that I liked in Vancouver, like 33 Acres, that you can't really find here.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I assume it doesn't make it to the States either. I don't know.
Yeah.
But these guys, you know, my longstanding sort of favorite for Ontario beer is Collective Arts.
Huh.
And they do a really beautiful job, really, really incredible. A lot of stuff that's pretty good, despite the fact that I have fairly narrow tastes when it comes to beer.
Yeah.
And these guys are getting right up there too. Cool room, nice spot to sit, nice patio that faces a little lake if you're there in the summer. So Boschkung Brewing.
Geez, I mean, I'm sure it's the same on your side of the border, but you know, we're just so spoiled for choice when it comes to good microbrews and tap
absolutely.
Rooms and just small breweries nowadays. I mean, we can't. You know, can't throw a rock from our house and you know, not hit, you know, two or three. I mean, they're popping up everywhere. And, you know, it's the difficult part is picking which one to try. And I kind of go through phases when it comes to beer. I mean, I haven't been drinking beer lately. It's been kind of more of a whiskey time around the fire kind of thing. But we're getting into that season where like a porter or a good stout or something just is so, so nice, feels so cozy. It's like, you know, it's like a meal in itself. So. Yeah.
I mean, for me, I'm that jerk that the memes make fun of. The only beers I like are kind of like the kind of strong, overdone IPAs. I didn't really come to beer. I was introduced kind of to a wider world of beer by my wife.
Yeah.
And so we like to make little derivations if we're going places, try and see if there's an interesting brewery nearby that you can check out and sit and have a, you know, basket of French fries and a beer. And
yeah.
She has much wider taste than I do, but I'm learning bit by bit. I mean, my home plate is still bourbon, but
yeah,
the selection really sucks in Canada right now. You can't get anything that's legitimately worth drinking or being excited about. It's just when the LCBO, which is our kind of liquor control unit here, where you buy everything in Ontario, when they do get something, there's like a crew of people that are ready for it. So, I mean, I can't tell you the number of times I drove 30 minutes to try and get a bottle of like okay bourbon, like say Blanton's.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's good. I like it. It's not amazing. It's not especially collectible, but in Ontario, that's like peak stuff out here.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
You know, you're not going to find like a nice Willet. You're not going to find any of the stuff that people get legitimately or the really rare stuff that people get excited about in the States. So
yeah.
It's nice to expand the horizons a little bit. And then also I'm getting older. A bourbon at the wrong time of day can give me a hangover. So I've lost some of the edge I had when I was younger, but
yeah, I think we've been encouraged in the past by a handful of people like, oh, you guys should do an episode on booze or on whiskey or whatever. And we legitimately probably could talk for a full show about our favorite, you know, rum, whiskey, beer, wine, whatever. It's just, you know, I guess I'm not sure if a full episode is merited, you know, given that there are probably a lot of listeners that don't drink or aren't that into it. But, you know, I mean.
Yeah, I also, you know, I like to be as cognizant as possible. And I know you do, too, that there's people listening who have overcome drinking problems.
Yeah, right.
And I'm not here to tell anyone to drink. I feel like the whole world is telling people to drink from the time you're about 14.
Yeah, right.
So I don't know that we need any. And there's also lots of great podcasts that already cover this.
Yeah.
Anyone can find it if they need it. It's not hard to find it in most places in North America. So
yeah, true enough. All right. Well, I think we should jump into the main topic. And I think on the way to the main topic, we are going to do a very appropriate. We're going to do a very appropriate wrist check, I think.
Yeah. We're both wearing the same thing.
Same thing.
What's on your wrist?
It's the Aquastar Deep Star 2. I have this shimmery blue dial on, and you do too, but a different color.
Yeah, I have the gray dial. That's what Rick was kind enough to send for my hands on.
Yeah.
That will have gone up on Hodinkee the same day that this came out on Friday. I guess we're just going to get into the main topic. We can start with the Aquastar. We're also going to talk a bunch about the new Tudor Pelagos FXD, which is a pretty exciting watch. It's I just find it really encouraging that Tudor's doing some weird stuff still. It's not just new dial colors.
Yeah, right.
But let's start with the Aquastar. You know, we're looking at, I'll run through the specs so we can get out of the way. This is a brand new watch, so I think a lot of people maybe haven't had the time to sit down and read the stories and check the website and stuff. But so for those of you who don't know it, it's a 37 millimeter steel skin diver style watch. It's a time only with small seconds, so it uses a Sellita SW290. It still has the sort of silvery sub dial, which how the chronograph operated, but in this case, that's your small seconds. No date on this one. 13 millimeters thick, including a domed crystal, and 46.5 millimeters lug to lug. It's 19 millimeter lugs, which is a bit of a dig against it, but we can get into this. I've fit 20 millimeter straps in it. They just kind of squeeze in. It doesn't seem like a big deal. And then, of course, the watch itself comes with some strap options. It's a sapphire crystal, 200 meters water resistance, a screw down crown. Gray, black, or blue. We've got blue and gray represented in the opinions in this show. It has sort of a pretty deeply aged treatment to the lume, but there isn't that many lume plots because of the dial layout, so I think it feels pretty balanced that way. And then it has the classic decompression bezel. It's bi-directional. If you make it in for the pre-order, you're looking at just under $1,500, $1,490, and if you hit up at retail, it'd be $1,890, and that, for that price, you get a leather strap and a Tropic rubber. My example came on a pretty nice, all things considered, a pretty nice Aquastar kind of seat belty NATO.
Yep, same here. Yeah, yeah.
So where did you land on this? And like, I think you have a pretty good understanding of the background, and then of course Aquastar relaunched with a larger version of the original chronograph. What, about 2 years ago?
Yeah.
Where does this hit you as far as compared to that and say originals, which are now, you know, low five figure watches?
Yeah, I it's funny. I think when the DeepStar came out, what was it, 2 years ago, the chronograph version, mm-hmm. which was kind of in some ways more authentic to the original DeepStar, except in size. I think some people, you know, a lot of people loved it. I love that watch. I wear it quite a bit. But some people kind of lamented the fact that it grew in size from what the original DeepStar was, which was this 37 millimeter case that we see on this one. And so it was with great curiosity that when this one arrived, I put it on. I was like, that's what the original, you know, felt like or feels like. And it's funny, there are a couple of weird first impressions or mind tricks that happen when I put this watch on. For one thing, because it's that smaller size, it has this quaint, I keep saying, like, jewel-like quality compared to the chronograph, which just feels more like a big, like, retro style tool watch. This one has this
like, actually feels a bit vintage.
It feels vintage.
Yeah.
And the other mind trick that it does is it looks so much like the standard DeepStar chronograph, but it's missing the pushers, obviously.
Yeah.
And then the dial's flipped. It's like a mirror image. So on the chronograph, the sub dial is on the right side. And then it has this little spinning propeller type thing on the left side for the running seconds. And then, of course, it has a big sweep hand, which is kind of not that noticeable, I guess, on the chronograph, because it doesn't have any like big lume flag or anything like else on it. So it sort of disappears on that one. So this, at a glance, like if you were to wear this or caught a photo of it, you know, a leaked photo on Instagram or something, like, you'd think, oh, he's just got a standard DeepStar on. But then like you look and it's like, wait a minute, where are the pushers? And wait a minute, the subdial's on the wrong side of the dial, and you know, because it's so close to that, and it still works as the DeepStar would have with this decompression bezel, and the 30 minute chronograph is arguably, you know, not as useful as just a standard, you know, time only dive watch. So I dig it. I mean, I think, you know, Gashani's worn it quite a bit since it arrived because it's smaller, and she was always kind of jealous of me being able to wear the bigger one, but now I've got this on today and it's pretty fantastic.
Yeah. And I think the interesting thing is in their kind of press release in the communication, which comes from, you know, Rick, who's been on the show. I don't know anyone who really understands dive watches in the same way that Rick does. He just has a real knack for recreating these things, but also if he's going to make a change, he it seems intentional, and kind of thoughtful. And in this case, they're quite clear that they're not trying to remake the original. Even in calling this the DeepStar 2, it's more of a, you know, what if Aquastar had survived the quartz crisis? What might have been the next thing they would have made?
Yeah.
Or another thing they would have made in the same lineage? And I think within that brief, this is a very successful watch. I think the pricing is super fair. You know, you're under $2,000, well under if you hit the pre-order.
Yeah.
The other thing that strikes me, and I know I've talked about my love of the originals and having tried to buy some in the past, I got priced out of that world. But this is just an absolutely gorgeous watch. And I like that they've made enough changes that I don't feel like I'm buying a direct homage to the original, you know, one from the 60s, right?
Yeah, right. Right.
I love something that comes in under, you know, under 40 millimeters. I say this a lot, so I don't have to push it, but I like thinking about watches that I'm buying now or might want to buy now as, you know, are these going to be something that my kids might want to wear? And I've got two girls, and I'm not saying that they wouldn't want to wear a 41 millimeter chronograph. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
But I think this might be a safer bet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who knows where the taste in watches will go? Maybe we'll all return to wanting 47 millimeter Panerai or something like that. But
right.
For the time being, I can only predict based on my own evolving taste. And as much as I love the chronograph, the previous chronograph, which is 41 millimeters, if you've ever put on a Black Bay, it wears like a Black Bay.
Mm-hmm.
Perfectly comfortable, but it's a big watch. It's both of those things.
Yeah.
This, on the other hand, I mean, you're under 47 millimeters lug to lug. The crown is the right size, so it's not digging into my wrist. It's big enough to be legible and have enough lume and to have an effect and to be have a feel on your wrist,
mm-hmm.
but not big enough to feel too big or too heavy or too hard to wear. You know, it was a little too late in the season for me to take it swimming or snorkeling or whatever, but I love a skin diver. This is just very, like the watch we're going to talk about in a couple minutes with the Tudor, very much up my alley. You know, this is maybe a little bit preaching to the choir. There's not really anything I don't like here.
Yeah.
I think this is a good use of aged lume.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the case is nicely made. It's just a simple brushed skin diver case, so you're not dealing with anything super fancy in terms of the finishing or otherwise. But yeah, I think Rick nailed it right out of the park.
Yeah, I think also, you know, for people that maybe were scared off by the Deep Star itself, the chronograph version that came out a couple of years ago, you get everything that's really great about the Deep Star, both the vintage, the original and the reissue from a couple of years ago. But you know, some people just aren't chronograph people. I mean, you've mentioned in the past that you're not so much a chronograph guy, and some people are, they don't need a chronograph. They don't like the complexity of a chronograph or the service price of a chronograph, as well as, you know, the smaller size on this is just, it's going to fit a huge range of wrists. I'm wearing it now on my 7.25 to 7.5 inch wrist. And as I said, Gashani's worn it a few times and it fits her and me equally well. I think it's great. And it still has those features that made the original Deep Star just such a design beauty, such a classic, that, like you mentioned, that font, that scripted Aquastar type at the top. And then there's something about that little star logo and then where it says Deep Star 220 ATM. I mean, it just feels so of an era. And then those big, long applied markers at 12, 3, and 6 are just, it still retains all of the goodness of the original Deep Star. And then you're getting a slimmer case, you know, shorter lug to lug, and then, you know, a simpler movement without the chronograph part of it. So yeah, I agree. I think it's great.
Yeah, I don't think it's as cool as being able to spend, say, $12,000 to $15,000 on a really clean original one.
Yeah.
Those are still OG, but like if you buy that and then you have to baby it, that would concern me. That would be instantly the most expensive watch I own.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's one of the most beautiful watches ever made, especially within like the sports, the 60s, the classic dive watch look.
Yeah.
I don't think that you could make a top 10 and not include that watch. I think you'd be sleeping on something that was really pretty beautiful and special at the time.
Yeah.
But in making this and making something that's hits an accessible price point, a price point that we really like. I look, under $2,000 is fantastic, right? Like there's a huge amount of competition from the standard sort of micro brands, say at $600 to $900.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is sort of your bump up. This is only a little bit more than something like an SPB.
Yeah.
And I think it's made a little better than the Seiko. It's a better movement. It's already keeping considerably better time than my SPB 143. And I adore the SPB, so that I don't think that's a dig against it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going to just do one and you still wanted a skin diver, you wanted something that's a nice size, this is even closer to the SLA in sizing. So the original 62 mass, if it matters.
Yeah.
I think the bezel on the SPB is much more useful for day to day.
Right.
Like this bezel is not that useful for me. I use the pip and just kind of if I want to time something.
Yeah.
But I ignore all of these little dashes and numbers and the rest of it. That's, you know, it's a reference for me, a nod to the past, if you will.
Yeah. I mean, I think there were multiple versions of this. There were some lesser known ones. There was actually a rally version of the Deep Star, which is sort of strange because it kind of crosses genres. And there was a rally version of the Deep Star that had a tachymeter.
Oh, wow.
Bezel version of this, which is kind of strange, but you know, who knows, if a 12-hour version or just a elapsed time or something would be maybe it's not out of the question, who knows. But I think it's a cool watch, and I think I think it'll be a hit. I think, you know, coming in at, I think the Deep Star chronograph re-release was about $1,000 more than this, both for pre-order and for the standard retail price. So I think, you know, even those that were a little put off by the price or any of the other things I mentioned. I mean, $1,490 if you get in on pre-order is a pretty killer deal for what we're both wearing here.
Yeah, and I mean the $1,890, it's hard to predict with these things, but they're making 300 of each colorway.
Yeah,
is the opening series. I guess that maybe that means they'll make more or different versions in the future. I'm not sure, but these ones are limited to 300. So I think the 18. I do almost wonder if they'll just all sell at pre-order. It's hard to predict.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it's easy to look at it and go like, oh, you know, it does cost more than the Seiko. It does cost more than a Halios or something like that. But I think given the limited production and the timing and the movement and the rest of it, I don't think it's out of line in terms of what it costs. But I do think that obviously the $400 you save to go pre-order makes sense, especially if you're already on board with the kind of the rest of what we've said.
Right. Yeah.
Who knows if they'll, which color might go first. I obviously have a strong preference for the gray, but having not seen the others, I have the chronograph in black, but I haven't seen the blue. My guess is it has a sort of vibe entirely its own.
I'm not a big blue dial guy myself, but this is pretty amazing. I mean, you know, oftentimes I think what happens is when you see blue dials in photos or especially like press photos, they come across kind of, dare I say, cheap feeling. They almost look a bit too bright blue, at least in my eyes. And I think this one in certain light is bright, but like right now I'm sort of slowly pivoting my wrist around and angling it. And it takes on, you know, seven different shades of blue depending on which way you're looking. And if I look at it straight on in kind of a slightly dark office that I'm sitting in, it's downright black looking. And there's a bit of sunburst to it, a bit of a shimmer. And then in certain light, those small loom markers, the round ones that are not the kind of the cardinal points, they kind of stand off in sort of a three-dimensional way. And it's really beautiful. I'm wondering, like you said, I wonder if there will be other colors. I know he did a green dial version, the Greenwich version of the chronograph. That would be interesting to see in this one too. But very cool.
I guess it depends on how quickly the 900... you know, that come up today actually sell through. I think a blue dial is one of the more challenging dials. I think it's easier to do a gray dial or a black dial, especially when you have some sunburst.
Yeah.
I think doing that with the blue, making sure that it works with the sort of old radium style Super Luminova and making sure you get a strap option that actually kind of pays into that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much more you had to say about this one. We can move on to the Pelagos.
Yeah. Speaking of blue watches.
Yeah. The other, you know, new dive watch we wanted to talk about, which just due to the lag in our recording, we had literally just recorded last week's episode. And then that afternoon I had my meeting at Rolex Canada. First time I've been to that building. Marvelous.
Wow.
Super fun, obviously. And to do that in person, to kind of do like a Basel World style meeting, you've got, I think I was there for about 45 minutes, which is a little longer than a Basel meeting, and especially for one watch. But to see that in person was pretty exciting. You know, this is a watch that a lot of you have emailed Jason and I about or DM'd us about with leaks. And, you know, Tudor is part of Rolex. Rolex doesn't say anything to anyone, really. Mm-hmm. So there was no way for us to confirm a leak. It's always easier just to say like, yep, I've seen it. I got nothing to say.
Yeah.
I don't think it's worth covering things like leaks typically, especially if they're already out there. There's a lot of really good rumor sites, if that's what you're into, Instagram as well. but we have the new Tudor Pelagos FXD. Should we do a list of specs for that one too, Jason? You think that works?
I think so. I mean, the first thing that leaps to mind is, you know, you have the list in our notes here, and it's 42 millimeters across and 52 millimeters lug to lug. But what I'm noticing is this 12.75 thick, which is, having just talked about the Aquastar, is actually slightly slimmer than the Aquastar. And yeah, from what I remember of the standard Pelagos, I mean, that's a considerable slim down.
Yeah, I believe the standard's 14.3 since they went to the MT-5612 movement.
Yeah.
So this is a consider, and it feels way thinner.
Really? Yeah.
The amount of space between, say, the inside edge of the crystal and the dial is much closer, much like it is on a Zin U1.
Sure.
Yeah. You just feel like they didn't build any thickness into the case. They just made each piece.
Yeah.
And that is kind of what you get where, you know, this is a, I'll run through the specs. It'll make it a little bit faster. 42 millimeter titanium case, like Jason said, 12.75 thick and 52 millimeters lug to lug. It uses a distinct, as in nobody else is doing this, especially not within Tudor or Rolex, titanium case that has channel lugs, which are kind of like a modern version of fixed spring bars, but it's not that the bar is welded where the bar holes would normally be. The channel is actually at the lowest part of the lug. So where the strap laces through the watch actually sits directly against your wrist rather than going up off your wrist a little bit, which is an important consideration for a watch of this size. It's almost creepy how comfortable it is. And you look at it and you go, I know this is 52 millimeters and I shouldn't be crazy about it, but it wears really lightly and evenly on your wrist.
Yeah.
It comes with both a rubber and a fabric strap. Both represent two of the nicest I've ever come across. The rubber is a single piece rubber with a buckle, a tang buckle. Definitely higher quality than, you know, the one we've talked about for years now, the ZD328. It's a step above that. It feels great. It looks great. And then the fabric strap is made by the same supplier that makes all the Black Bay fabric straps. And it uses like a hook and loop sort of Velcro style secure.
Yeah.
For that, both are single piece, both lace through. You can only run essentially NATO style straps with this, or Maritax, or however you want to call them. 200 meters water resistance. So keep in mind, a normal Pelagos is 500. We're also, the big part with the thinness is no more HEV. The watch was made with a specific design brief provided by the combat swimming part of the Marine National. They're called the Commando Hubert. And so they removed the HEV because they don't need that. The bezel and dial are now a darker blue, so it's less purpley is the easiest way I would describe it. The blue Pelagos, the standard blue Pelagos, has a bit of a purple hue to it, which gives it this sort of brightness.
Yeah.
And this, I wouldn't call this navy blue. It's very saturated, darker blue than the more purpley one of the other. It's a brand new bezel, size and sort of grip. It really is, like, in many ways an entirely different watch. There's so many tweaks here. It's a different case. It's a different movement. We're now at the no date movement, so that's part of the thinness as well. So that's the MT5602, which we've seen in like the Black Bay Dark as well, which is a no date 41 millimeter Black Bay.
Yeah.
A little bit less dial text. Everything is still loomed. It's a fully graduated bezel, so you get markings all the way around the bezel. And then, like I said, this was made in conjunction. You have to be kind of specific about the wording here because this is not a military issued watch. If you can imagine, I think it's a fair assumption to say that like a modern military outfit isn't going to spend $3,900 per watch of taxpayer money.
Right.
And also the world of like issued watches is not really the same as it was when, say, the MNs were being issued in the 60s and 70s, right?
Right.
So this was made in conjunction via a brief from the Commando Hubert. It was then approved by the MN to be used for underwater navigation. The new bezel is bidirectional with a countdown scale for that specific purpose. It's not an ISO dive watch. It's not a classic dive watch. These guys don't swim deep enough to be worried about bottom time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actively in use by the commandos, but it is fair. It wouldn't be fair to say that it's issued. They're not being given this watch. This is a watch kind of designed with help from this outfit. It's a big, interesting release from Tudor. It's the first like big evolution of the Pelagos. Obviously, we went from ETA to in-house, and then from in-house with in-house came Blue, and then later we had the LHD, which kind of was the biggest one. Now we have FXD. FXD, for those who missed it, is a kind of a compression of fixed.
Oh, sure.
It's a Pelagos with fixed lugs. Jason, where do you land on this? What do you think of it? It's $3,900, so it's a little bit less than the cost of a. It's about $500 less ish than a standard Pelagos, but you don't get the bracelet. You know, no HEV, which is good. But what do you kind of think of this, having, you know, not seen it in person just yet?
I'm a huge fan of it. I don't know if it's a watch I would personally own, but I have to just be utterly thrilled that a company, a big company like Tudor, is mm-hmm. releasing strange watches like this. I mean, what other brand, you know, big brand these days is doing anything with fixed spring bars or you know, any sort of a NATO only strap option?
Yeah.
You know, I've got multiple CWCs that come with fixed bars based on the MOD spec and their history. But for Tudor to kind of build a case that has these really cool channel kind of strap feed system, kind of like I guess what Autodromo did, right? With the
that's the only other one I know of, and that's where I kind of learned this term channel lugs.
Yeah,
I don't even know if that's a real term. I picked that up off of like WatchySeek years ago when I was obsessed with the Group B.
But I've always loved that look. I think it's I think I saw there was like a dive computer years ago that had this, and I thought, boy, that's such a cool idea. But for a brand to do that, a big brand that is selling watches to, you know, for a fair amount of money to people that like to swap straps around and like a bracelet option, it's a bold mm-hmm. move to go this route, to sell a watch that has only the option of using fabric straps, you know, for this amount of money to an audience that largely likes a bracelet option and likes to change straps a lot, is a really bold move. You know, it's almost to the degree of the P01 that Tudor released a couple of years ago with those really funky kind of hinged lugs and strange strap configuration and the bezel. And I applaud that. I think it's great. I like bidirectional bezels. I'm not a huge fan of countdown bezels. I just don't find them useful in almost any respect. I just don't find myself needing to count things down. I mean, even if it's making pasta or a parking meter, the kind of the cliched pedestrian uses of dive bezels, I think it's still easier to count up. But, you know, hey, I mean, if they built it to a specific spec and they kind of want to frame it that way, that's certainly fine. But yeah, I mean, no HEV, I'm a huge fan. you know me, and 200 meter water resistance, if you're going to keep the watch slimmer, I think that's always a good thing. I can't wait to try it. I mean, I hope one makes its way through town here. Maybe there already is one at one of the Tudor dealers here, but I would love to.
It's quite likely.
Put one on my wrist and take a peek at it.
Yeah, and you know, I already did an episode about this watch for Hodinkee Radio, just because the timing of the episodes worked out, and I really didn't want to share my opinion, which this is more the venue for that. I wanted to get this kind of collector perspective, so I called Ross Povey, who we know, the Tudor collector.
Yeah,
Ross is excellent, and he was exactly what I wanted, which was like, I wanted to understand this from someone who lives and breathes just Tudor,
mm-hmm.
really understands the kind of military history, really understands the design legacy, and kind of even sees things outside of the hype.
Yeah,
in that has the context to just see the watch for what it is to someone who loves Tudor. And one of the big things that he brought up that I did not even think about, it's not in my original write-up, any of it, is that these are engraved with the MN logo, but also say MN21 in reference to the way they would have been engraved as issued pieces back in the day with the year that they were issued.
Yeah.
But he said, you know, that's going to make a big difference to a collector, because there's only like 6 weeks left in November, and then it's going to be MN22.
So right, the key here is, this episode, I'm going to run out and buy one.
Right? There's going to be some people who really, really buy it because it's a no date.
Sure.
Blue MN style watch that has MN21 on it, and it'll be rare. There just won't be as many as there will be next year, or theoretically the year after. I don't think this is going to be a high production watch to begin with. So we might actually be talking about actual rarity, not just the word rare compared to how many watches Tudor makes in general.
Yeah.
I think this is a really interesting watch. I don't think it's the Pelagos I would buy. I've had time to think about this. This is what I asked Ross at the end of the H Radio episode.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which one would you buy? And it was a very fast answer for him. This is the Pelagos for him. It's the one that he likes. He's an FXD guy. For me, I still, weirdly enough, despite my general indifference towards bracelets, I love the normal Pelagos' bracelets so much.
Yeah.
I don't think that this makes my longstanding kind of Pelagos conundrum any easier. This is a little bit cheaper, which is nice. I think they've made some very like specific updates. The other thing I'll bring up, because it's in the comments constantly, is people don't understand the bezel markings. where some spans have four marks and some have three. It's a direct pull of the MOD styling. And you can see it quite specifically on mil subs as well. It's a reference to just the sort of military legacy of Tudor and Rolex's work in that space. But you'll have different markings depending on where you are in the bezel. And it's just meant for speed and accuracy when you're getting closer to the pip. That's all.
But people
seem confused on that or upset about it or whatever. And it is, if you look at the bezel on a sort of MOD dive watch or a mil sub, I think it becomes a little bit more obvious what they're working towards. It's not exactly the same, but it's very similar.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the reaction oftentimes, the initial reaction that people have when they see a watch like this is, would I buy this, or was this a swing and a miss, or was this, you know, like with the P01 or this one? These are quirky watches, and I think we have to applaud a big brand like Tudor for even making them. And the fact that it is going to be more of a niche watch for a very specific kind of person, I think, is what makes it cooler. So, you know, the Pelagos, what so many people have talked about, myself included, and you just mentioned, is that superb bracelet that the original Pelagos comes with. I mean, it's like almost like its calling card is that floating clasp and just the beautifully done bracelet. And this one doesn't have that. And you think, oh, you know, they've really missed the boat here by deleting that piece of it that is so popular on the standard Pelagos. But
yeah,
the fact that they made this one that can only take a fabric strap was something that to make a very niche product. I mean, I know you've talked about it with cars in the past, but for a brand to make something so just so peculiar is just something worth celebrating in my mind. And I think it will make it, you know, not to be a big future prognosticator, but, you know, like, can you imagine in 25 years if you had an MN21 Pelagos FXD when, you know, they stopped making it after 3 or 4 years, and it's almost like the North Flag, like they've stopped making the North Flag, and that was kind of a quirky, weird watch that, you know, people are going to wish they had bought in 10, 20 years.
Yeah, and I mean, assuming people are still into watches then as we are now, then I think that's an absolutely fair prediction that people will have had the time to learn about how many were maybe made, how many have been seen, what they kind of do at auction, that sort of thing, and then you'll see these collectors. But I think what's important here is Tudor does something that Rolex doesn't, and Tudor does something that a lot of other brands don't do, which is they are willing to make a play to a very specific window of people.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes a big splash in that community, even if everyone else who kind of already has the watch they want, give or take. And I can get to that part in a moment. But like the P01 was for a very specific niche, and that niche really likes it. And I think that perspective, that kind of thought towards product design and implementation should be exalted to some level, even if you don't like the product that much.
Yeah, yeah.
It's one thing to do a special edition. We're seeing the kind of peak of special edition in the sports car world, just milking it. This isn't a special edition. This isn't like a slightly different Pelagos. This isn't a Pelagos with an MN logo on the dial that's otherwise the same.
Yeah.
Those are all things they could have done and the watch would have sold.
Yeah.
Right? This is something specific for a specific group of people. And part of that group is this Commando Uber, and they're actually using it for the underwater. And I think that adds a lot of coolness for the casual buyer who likes this watch and will see it and kind of go after it. And I think it's just a world of like, sometimes you just need some context.
Yeah.
My first gut reaction was probably like a lot of people listening. Why is it 52 millimeters lug to lug?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Yeah.
And then I actually put it on my wrist and it doesn't, because of the weird shape of the case and the way it sits and the decent strap. And even when I put it on a 22 millimeter Uta NATO, it just sits really nicely. Don't get me wrong. It's not a small watch. It's not, it can't hide the 52 millimeters. It's not going to suddenly feel like 46.
Yeah, yeah.
But it doesn't wear like a 52 millimeter dive watch normally would, because it's not like other dive watches. It has this very, very strange kind of ingenious little case design. And I think that they've made something for a certain type of collector, and that not everybody kind of immediately saw that context. I saw the lug to lug and the fact that it's not a Pelagos 58, like a smaller standard Pelagos, which is still something that I'm begging for. I don't know if we'll ever actually see the Pelagos GMT at this point. It's just become this kind of joke.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a bit. And I also think that they made something that has enough of a take to be divisive
and
cause some controversy and some kind of discussions. You know, does it really matter if it's issued or not issued? I don't know how you could expect a watch, especially a $4,000 Swiss watch, to be an issued watch anymore.
Yeah, right. I think, you know, people in the military and those out there that are listening that are part of the military can correct me. I think there's a sense of heritage, and I think there's a sense of tradition if you're in the military. And I think this reminds me a bit of the Bremont HMAF collection, their Her Majesty's Armed Forces collection, where, you know, there's nobody's pretending that you know, RAF pilots are wearing that mono pusher aero chronograph, but it's so many military outfits will get these small run customized dial CWCs and Rolexes and Omegas and Bremonts and Breitlings and things, and they wear them proudly, and they might not wear them while they're, you know, out, you know, kicking down doors and flying sorties and things like that. But, you know, when they're off duty or, you know, off base or whatever, I mean, they love this stuff. And I think this will be something like that.
Ultimately, I don't know how much that would matter to me personally, but I do understand why somebody else might attach to it as like, that's what would make me buy the watch or not. I don't have a strong enough military connection, especially to a military that isn't even of my own nation.
Yeah.
for it to matter to me very strongly.
Yeah.
I once met a fella at one of the first watch meetings I ever went to in Toronto before I lived in Vancouver, as I was just kind of getting into writing about watches. And he had a Canadian Coast Guard Tudor.
Oh, sure.
A black Tudor sub that was for the Canadian Coast Guard. Now that, I get it. Mm-hmm. So I have to be fair.
Yeah.
Maybe if you're French, maybe if you really love military connections, that adds a big appeal.
Yeah.
But I don't think the way that this has been sort of presented or the way that it works out necessarily detracts
right.
from what they've made, which is one of the biggest watch brands in the world. Certainly the sister brand to the largest, most prolific watch brand in existence has made something weird and fun and special and different. And I think that's the way I attached the story once I had some time to absorb it.
You know, I'm looking at your post on Hodinkee from last week when you first introduced the watch, and just scrolling through the photos. And I one of my favorite views of the watch is you took a case back view with the strap removed, and it's just this like chunk, you know, I mean, it's a single piece. It just looks like it was just like carved out, you know, the channels for there's a difference, you know, with the CWCs that I have with the fixed spring bars. Like you can actually see where it was kind of welded and then polished out where the spring bars went in.
Right.
And like, this is like, this case was designed as like a single piece, the movement dropped in and then like run a strap through it and go. And I love that very solid kind of look to it. I think that I might even be my favorite view of the watch is just that back view looking straight down at the case back. No clear case back, you know, whatever. It's just super cool. I mean, I think this is that kind of watch with no date, titanium, and just a single chunk of metal, you know, with a strap run through it. It is that kind of watch that almost encourages you to just thread a strap through it and off you go.
Get after it for sure. Yeah. No, I think, you know, I've said it 100 times, you know, I think they did well.
Yeah.
I get that there's some controversy. I also understand that I've learned, because I've written about almost every Tudor that's come out in the last couple years, mm-hmm. certainly.
Yeah.
Certainly any dive watch has landed on my plate. Thankfully, the brand likes to give me the opportunity to see and take pictures of these things. I think it's a very flattering thing. I don't know how Tudor sees it, of course, but I see it as a very flattering thing that people feel very personal about what Tudor makes.
Yeah.
If I was Tudor, I would think there's no way I could buy this attention.
Yeah.
But it's a double-edged sword, because if you don't deliver... You know, they put out a Black Bay 58 Blue, which is probably my favorite watch they make,
mm-hmm.
Or at least in the top three with the Blue Pelagos and the FXD.
Yeah, yeah.
They make the blue 58, and a lot of people got upset that it was just another colorway, but then the comment right below it is the alternate. It's all I wanted was the blue one, which is where I land. People seem to have a very personal opinion of how well Tudor delivers exactly what they wanted.
right.
People give Rolex a pass because they're this nameless, faceless monolith.
Right, right.
That you kind of, you know, you pay deference at the throne and maybe you get a watch. And I think that has a lot of baggage to it that doesn't necessarily exist for Tudor.
Yeah, yeah.
But people seem to take it personally. And I don't know where that started or how it started.
Yeah.
It could be that they came back to the North America, well, to the America and UK markets in a very specific enthusiast focused way with the Black Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have an enthusiast audience, a deep enthusiast audience. And I think people didn't get what they wanted from the P01, if they wanted a kind of a vintage reissue of a sub, and then the 58 was the wrong color, it's this color or that color, or listen to me, I how many times have I talked about the GMT?
Right.
Tudor's a special brand, and people seem to interface with it differently.
Yeah, true.
But I hope that doesn't put them in a position where they don't want to take interesting, fun risks like with the FXD or the P01. I wasn't crazy about the P01. I don't see the point.
Mm-hmm.
But I have met people who gave me a different context. He said, no, I love this watch. I think it's very cool for these reasons.
Yeah.
You know, I hope Tudor can contextualize the feedback they get sometimes, where I think in many ways it's people saying, like, we love you. Do this for me, please. Right. And right. And that's not really how you make a watch brand that makes this many watches a year.
Yeah.
Or at
yeah.
least not always. They made something niche for a group of people here.
Yeah.
Both yeah. of these watches really capture elements of the way I really interface with the dive watch world. But in you couldn't have two more different watches. They're not made out of the same materials.
Right.
They're not the same size. They don't look the same. The Pelagos is like resolutely modern.
Mm-hmm.
And even down to its very philosophy, the DS2 is the opposite of modern. They just wanted a thought exercise of like what might have come next if Aquastar had continued.
Yeah, I think this was a fun episode. I remember when you know, the Pelagos came out last week and we kind of just missed it for last week's mm-hmm. episode. And then the timing with the Aquastar, it's just perfect. So I was excited to kind of have this chat today. And it's kind of a good old-fashioned just kind of, you know, talk about watches episode, which is a lot of fun. I hope people enjoy it. And we'd love to hear the comments. I'm sure everybody's going to have all sorts of feedback on both of these.
And if we miss something, if there's a question that you have, if we didn't get it in the spec list, if whatever, just put it in the comments on notes.thegreynato.com and I'll answer, Jason answered, or address it to us specifically if you need it. We can answer all these questions and that sort of thing. I wanted to put these in one episode because I felt that they were very different, but they're both kind of skin divers.
Yeah.
There hasn't been a lot of like really amazing, exciting watches that are accessible to a certain extent these days. You know, it's impossible to buy a Rolex and it doesn't always seem like that brand wants to iterate to keep us excited.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas at least this is something we can sit and chat about and have an argument or a difference of opinions, whether it's on either of these watches. I think they're both very successful in what they set out to do.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on to final notes.
Yeah, yeah.
I can go first because I think mine sort of relates to, well, I suppose both of these watches, but maybe more so towards the new Pelagos FXD. And I recently picked up a new strap, a NATO strap from CWC. So CWC sells obviously watches, but they also have a small strap shop where they do kind of standard NATOs that they source from Phoenix, the old maker of the original MOD NATOs. But then they've got one on their site now that I recently bought. It's called the NATO Stretch watch strap. And it's the format is a standard NATO strap, but the material is quite stretchy. You had asked if it's kind of similar to the straps from Erica's, and it is sort of along those lines. I would compare, I don't know if you've tried one of Nick Mankey's straps. He makes
the
stretchy straps that you can thread and right. use on a Garmin. I would compare it to that. It's a really high quality material that has a fair amount of stretch to it, but it doesn't feel kind of rubbery and elastic. And I think that material with the NATO format solves a big problem in my head when it comes to NATOs. And I think, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, you know, you always use a NATO when you're diving. And actually I don't, because a NATO is one of those straps that there's no give to it. And so
none. Yeah.
If you're diving and you don't set it properly before you descend and your suit shrinks and the strap gets wet, the watch can kind of spin around on your wrist. And if you over tighten it, it feels like a tourniquet, et cetera. Well, the cool thing about this one is it's a NATO strap, but you can pull it a little bit tighter to utilize the stretchy aspect of the material, and it'll stay nicely firmly in place on your wrist. And
it's cool.
I didn't just buy it for diving. Obviously, I think it has a nice texture to it. It looks good. It comes in set. They're offering 7 different colors, and I'm not a huge stripey fan, although I do have a soft spot for the Bond. So I got the Bond striped one, and I think what I like about this Bond version is it's the gray is a darker gray, and it's not the outer color. I think a lot of the Bond straps, it's like a lighter gray, and then the two stripes are black, if I'm not mistaken. And this one has it kind of the opposite. So it wears a lot darker. And I just think it looks really good. And I'm wearing it mainly on CWCs, but I've tried it on a couple of other watches. But they do also have the green with the yellow stripe that was kind of the original strap that came on the Tudors, made of the parachute strapping material. And then they've got some black with red, black with gray, a full red one, which is the only solid color version. Well, I guess they've also got a straight black one as well. But I hope they do come out with some other colors, because I just think it's a nice option. These go for about 18 pounds, which is, you know, what, 20, somewhere close to 25 bucks.
22, 25 yeah, bucks, yeah. Something like that.
So not horrible and really well made. And if you're looking for something a little different in a NATO strap, I encourage you to check that out. Especially for the new Tudor, might be a good choice for the Pelagos FXD.
Might be just the thing. I like these quite a bit. That's a cool idea. I like the idea of having some stretch in your watch band.
Yeah.
And I would agree. Let's see some more colors. Let's see an Admiralty gray.
Yeah.
Standard gray with a brushed hardware would be pretty killer. I definitely could see myself going that direction. And then, you know, that's the color that Phoenix has used for a long time for the gray NATO. It's where we based our color code for the show on is Admiralty gray and that sort of thing. So as always, CWC does lovely work. And this seems very like a solid product for the money. Right. So very cool.
What have you got?
Mine is a bit of a left field option, but it was just something that, when I was coming home from Germany, I had, this is going to be 13 hours or something with a mask on. And I was looking just to feel a little bit happier and not think about work for at least just a few minutes. And then I looked at my podcast feed and I've been enjoying a podcast. I've mentioned it before, but I've been enjoying a podcast called The Rewatchables, which is a huge podcast. Most people who would like it in the audience probably already know about it, but it's from The Ringer, which is typically a sports website. But The Rewatchables is a podcast that looks into movies with high rewatchability. So like the kind of movie where if you caught it on cable on a Saturday afternoon, you'd go, oh, I love this scene. And then you would end up watching the whole thing. Right.
Right. Right.
It's one of my favorite movie podcasts along with Blank Check. If you haven't listened to that, that's fantastic. But The Ringer, one of the things I really like about these guys is Bill Simmons and the team there, they have a real love for the movie Heat, which is one of my absolute favorite movies, easily my favorite movie from the 90s. And I believe it was maybe the first rewatchable they ever did was Heat. And then at a certain number, they did the reheat, where they just kind of dug back into it with the new form. The show had evolved in its format and its scope, and it was a little bit more produced by that point. So they did it again. And then they said, someday we'll do the three heat, but only if we can get Michael Mann.
Yeah.
And I always kind of figured they wouldn't do it. Michael Mann's not a guy that necessarily pops up on podcasts. If for those of you who don't know, he's the director of the movie Heat, along with a lot of really other fantastic movies that we've talked about, many in the TGN Film Club. I'll put a show note in there. We don't have to go too deep into that part. But they got him. So wow. I was sitting in Frankfurt Airport. The lounge was closed, so I had to sit just in a normal spot and just hang out for the several hours until the flight. The flight changed gates like four or five times. It was kind of stressful. And I had this to listen to. And for them to be able to take all of their kind of beliefs and opinions and a lot of like rumors and conjecture about the production of the movie and the various actors and who might have had other roles and all these sorts of things, and just have Michael Mann be like, no, that's not real. Yeah, that was real. No, that's not real. And then provide all this great context. He was also like super open to chat about stuff, which I didn't really expect. Yeah. He seems very intellectual, very thoughtful in his process, but not necessarily very accessible in many ways. And it was clear that he had a respect for what they had done and how much they loved his movie.
Yeah.
Maybe he didn't understand just how much they love Heat. I thought it was great. If you like Heat, it's simply amazing. I don't see how anyone who appreciates either Heat or Michael Mann's movies wouldn't absolutely love this episode. I've listened to it twice. I'll probably listen to it again at some point. Once I got home, I rewatched Heat just to kind of fill in some of these additional blanks. It's a movie I watch every few months, and I'm so thrilled that they were able to do the three Heat. So that's definitely my final note for the week.
Oh, that's cool. They got Michael Mann. I think that sets the bar high. I think we need to get like Denny Villeneuve on TGN Film Club someday or something, right?
I would. Yeah, I mean, someday that'd be great. Denny, if any of Denny's people are listening, we'll roll out the red carpet. It'll be a fun episode, I promise.
Yeah,
we could talk all about. I just got a chance to check out Dune. We can talk about that maybe on a future film club. It's I'm not going to ruin anything for anyone about that movie. It's a treat. Check it out.
Oh.
We love Villeneuve here. Dune is something else entirely. Now I need to read the book to really understand. There's a lot of stuff I didn't fully grasp. I've never read the book, but that'll be on my kind of winter reading list before I rewatch it, and certainly before the second half comes out, part two.
Wow.
Killer stuff.
All right. Well, good show, couple good watches, some good final notes, and as always, thanks so much for listening. You can subscribe to the show notes via notes.thegranado.com or check the feed for more details and links. You can follow us on Instagram at Jason Heaton, at J.E. Stacey, and follow the show at The Granado. If you have any questions for us, please write thegranado@gmail.com and keep sending those voice memos. If you're enjoying the show, please do subscribe and review wherever you find your podcasts. And music throughout is Siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
And we leave you with this quote from Epictetus, who said, "Anything worth putting off is worth abandoning altogether."